isolated. All right, the time is 3:05. Mayor's appointee is vacant. Ward 1 is vacant. Ward 2, Commissioner Burke notified me that he would not be available today. Ward 3 is vacant. Ward 4, Mr. Andrews.
Present.
Ward 5, Commissioner Chairperson Clark.
Present.
And Ward 6, Chairperson or Vice Chairperson Pauley.
Here.
All right. Chairman, you do have a quorum.
Thank you. Item 2 on the docket is approval of the December 6th meeting minutes. Has everyone had the chance, opportunity to examine them?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I read through the minutes and I would make a motion that we approve them as written.
Do I have a second?
I can second that. I just had one minor typo that I had emailed to Aaron yesterday. It's in item number 4. It's the word "within" instead of "within the city's yes. enterprise resource." Just a minor thing.
And changed on the updated draft. Drop the G.
Otherwise, I'll second that motion.
Any further discussion? May we have a vote?
Ward 4, Commissioner Andrews.
Approve.
Ward 5, Chairperson Clark.
Approve.
And Ward 6, Vice Chairperson Pollard.
Approved.
Motion passes.
Thank you. Staff update.
Chairperson Clark, that will be me today. All right. Staff update, business services. We have a quick staff update. First is changes to business services staff. So they have a structure of a director and two deputy directors. One of the deputy directors is stepping over to our housing and community development department to assist with management there. City manager asked me to step in as the deputy director controller for an interim period of time. So that's why I'm giving the update today. So I'll be stepping into that role to help with financial oversight and free up the other deputy director to focus on the budget process. The updates they have is their budget cycle for fiscal year 25 is underway. This is the part of the year where they have a budget calendar with a schedule of when they meet with staff. They're currently meeting with directors. I think they have a preliminary update to mayor and council, just a very first step into their process this month. So later this month will be their first presentation on that. For the fiscal reports, the annual comprehensive financial report for fiscal year 24, that was the one that ended as of June of last year. That report is currently being a final audit by the external auditors. They expect to be done with their review and comments and issued within the next 2 weeks. So by the time we meet again, the annual financial report for last fiscal year should be issued.
Is it the same external auditing firm that has done in the past?
Yes. So last year compared to this year, same firm. So it's Heinfeld and Nietzsche this year. I'm not sure when every 5 years, I believe they have to go out for another bid process. I'm not sure where they're at. If it's not this year, it's very close. All right. Any other questions or anything I can answer for you?
Thank you. Congratulations, I think.
Sure. Thank you. All right. Then agenda item number 4, we do have Blake here to speak about the items.
Yeah, thank you, Commission. Thanks you for having me. So my name is Blake Olofsson. I'm the traffic engineering administrator at the Department of Transportation and Mobility. And I gave this presentation last year or some time ago. And I was asked again, I'm happy to do that. So I was going to just go over sort of the same format that I did last time, and stop me if you have questions anytime. And then I have some other information I want to share too. So I just have to preface this as I'm going to show you some statistics. I just really need to explain this, and I know this might be a little confusing, but when, you know, when there's a crash incident on the roadways, you know, TPD, depending on the severity of it, you know, arrives, or you can self-report your incident and it goes on an Arizona State Department of Transportation crash reporting form. And all of those are collected. And, you know, so TPD is the primary holder of that information since they collect it. But the process is that at the end of the year, like this time of the year and beginning of the next calendar year, all that information gets submitted to ADOT up in Phoenix, and they kind of scrub that data and verify it, make sure, you know, it's accurate to the best of their knowledge. And then that gets submitted to the federal government. And that report is like the official data, and that doesn't even come out till like June or July, which is extremely frustrating in my profession because, you know, we want to see up-to-date information. So what I have today for you is that the 2022 data didn't come in until I think September of last year. But I do have some stuff from 2023 to show you because I'm sure you're interested. I'm going to try and share my screen here. And so these are printouts from Pima Association of Governments. They're our local regional metropolitan planning organization. And they, you know, the data comes in sort of this raw tabular format, which is really not useful for anyone. And they have developed this program that displays it in any kind of form you want to query. So that's what I'm showing you here today. So the first graph is, or the first group of pages I'm going to go over is pedestrian fatalities. So this is, they do a 5-year summary. And because I'm doing this, I might have trouble if someone raised their hand, so just shout out. So this is just a heat map of incidents over the 5-year period. And then I just posted on here the totals for just to kick it off here for 2022 and 2023. And I just cut and pasted this from TPD's last report. So as you can see, this is compared 2022 to 2023, 99 total fatalities in 22, 95 in 23. And, you know, it's always sad, but the numbers were still up higher than we'd like, obviously, but the drop in pedestrian crashes or fatalities is really encouraging, 20 less this calendar year. Bicycles, and I'll do bicycles after the pedestrians here, they tend to hover around 6, 5, 6, 7. Motorcycle, it varies, but these, you know, you can see 17 and 20 are close. So the uptick, the difference was really in vehicle to vehicle collisions that resulted in fatalities, 27 to 39. So those are the numbers for 22 versus 23. So again, going back to 22, this is the summary, and I put again 23, 29 fatalities. And so the year over year, we had a pretty big jump there in 22 from the previous years. And then this is where these reports get a little difficult to interpret. So over those 5 years, there's 169 incidents. So just keep that in mind, because the way they present the data here, and I remember going over this before and it's a little confusing, is total people involved. So basically, if you have 169 incidents, you're going to have like roughly twice that many people involved. Obviously, you know, they're not all injured, but they're involved in the incident. The thing, and this is not on TPD or anything like that, it's just the way the crash reporting form is. When it's a pedestrian fatality, the way the form set up, it doesn't really allow the officer to indicate the direction. Like any normal vehicle crash, they would say like left turn, rear end, straight, like that. But they just get lumped in this other. But there is some improvement on that, and I'll show you down below here. So again, 169 incidents. And then this is, you know, just to be clear here. So this says 179. You're like, why is it not 169? Well, some of them were multi-pedestrian incidents where like two people were crossing and one died and one, and they're designated here. This is incapacitating and non-incapacitating. And incapacitating is typically like you need to go to the hospital. You got a broken arm, broken leg. And non-incapacitating is, you know, like minor cuts and scrapes. So that's the discrepancy there, or the explanation. So this is where it gets a little murky, but again, it is cleared up at the end, so bear with me. So they say physical condition operator. So this is, they're kind of lumping all of the people involved in this graph, which is really not that helpful, because if you say, look at alcohol, drugs, multiple means multiple impairment substances. But it really doesn't help you because you don't know if it was the driver or the person. So that's really not helpful. Now, if you go to the other side, it has fatal injury status. So this obviously is the person that was killed. And then, so I put it on here. I did some math. So 49% were impaired to some degree. Unknown is problematic because lots of times by the time the report's filed, they didn't follow up with the medical examiner, so they don't know if they were impaired. Now, TBD does a really good job internally of following up that information, and I talked to one of my colleagues over there, and they'll have that information, and he said earliest February, but that really, they do a really good job, again, of like getting into the weeds on the circumstances of what happened and closing the, I don't know, the file on it, is a better lack of words.
A question.
Sure. Yeah.
Excuse me. If the police do a more intensive investigation and they're reporting internally, what are these forms used for? Wouldn't that information be helpful? Or aren't these forms used in any way that requires that kind of information?
Well, I'm not sure I understand the question. So,
you indicated that sometimes the form doesn't allow the reporting officer to include certain information.
No, I wouldn't say that. What I was trying to say is that the way the form is structured, it's a standard form. The state, you know, mandates that. For some reason, the data reporting back that I get does not indicate which direction the vehicle was traveling when the pedestrian was struck. It just says other. And
my question goes, what are these forms used for? Would that information be useful? And if so, to whom? If you're looking to correct difficulties in intersections or streets, you might need that information.
Yes and no. I think that the when I get to the bottom, it might be more clear. I'd be able to answer that better. So if you just bear with me for a second here. Obviously, you know, the more data we have and the more accurate it is, the better information and better decisions we can make. So let me just go through and I'll show you down here. So back to the physical condition status of the pedestrians, 49% impaired. Again, 62 unknown, didn't get reported for whatever reason. You know, sometimes these people are in the hospital for a very long time. And, you know, I'm not, you know, I can't answer why, you know, what the reporting gap is for, as a traffic engineer. I don't know that would be a question for TPD. or the state. let's see. Oh, light conditions. So almost only 17% during daylight. So during darkness, even lit streets, is 80% of the fatalities. Not much to glean here from directions or road surface condition. Okay, so this would be the so traffic control. So vast majority are not happening at signals or HOCs, pedestrian hybrid beacons. 80 at signal, 19 at pedestrian hybrid, 5 stop signs. So this falls in line with what I shared last time I was with you, and this year is the vast majority of pedestrian fatalities happen at night with pedestrians crossing mid-block, not in a crosswalk. So this I think this is the one that maybe answers your question. So for each of these incidents, the driver, okay, so here's the driver. That's kind of what you're asking, I think. The driver was going straight ahead 159 times, making a left turn 9, making a right turn 4, avoiding object, pedestrian 1. So clearly, again, I think we've all experienced it. You drive down Broadway, Speedway, and the pedestrian seems to pop out from the median, and that's what I see. From the data, again, pedestrian crossing road, and then of course, okay. So then these are the age group of the operator. 25. It's kind of misleading here. 25 to 64. I mean, that's the biggest population group. That's going to come out in the data. We do use this for. Young driver, like near schools, high schools primarily, we can see if we're kind of outside of the norm for those geographic locations. And then males tend to take more risks, so we see that in the gender breakdown. And this is just the end of the report disclaimer. So I was going to jump over to bicycles if there was no questions.
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Mr. Olson, Brian Andrews, I wonder if you might describe the graph unit action by type, improperly parked and driverless. And then there's also a properly parked and driverless category. Each have one for the statistic. What does that measure exactly?
I do not know the answer to that. I would have to ask TPD, and I can do that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have one more question on this, if I can just find the area here. Physical condition of the operator, there are 116 unknowns.
Again, that is just the box that the officer checked when they filled out the form. So they are a physical condition operator, unknown 116. I don't know why they would check that box. I mean, these are, again, so it's kind of, I should have given you the blank form, but there's 300 fields on there and they check what they check, but I don't know what unknown is. I'll ask them.
Thank you.
Yes. All right. If no more questions, I'll move on to bicycles. Okay, let's see. Okay, so bicycles, again, less, you know, less incidents. Usually hovers around 4-5 a year, like you're seeing here. 24 incidents over 5 years, fatal incidents. This was fatal 24. Fatal 24. This is how the report comes out. So 42% were of the bicyclists were impaired. Put that on there. You're seeing double again, 49 because of the two people involved in an incident. I just thought of this, you could do math because two, so if one of the bicyclists was impaired, two of the motorists were, three drugs, or I guess that'd be one drugs for motorists. The light conditions, daylight predominantly. Oh, helmets. Helmet use 3, none use so unknown. They just check that box. I wish they didn't have that box to check. Direction. Not really gleaning anything there. Okay, so this is traffic control device, no control. So that would be, and I have the more detail coming down here in a second. No controls, 42, signal 4, stop sign 3. So this one's more useful, right? This is the same as the PED one. So driver going straight, driver making right, 0 left turn, I wouldn't guess that. The cyclist going straight, 9, changing lanes, 3, crossing road, 2, making a left turn, 2.
What's an other, again?
Again, that they have that box. They have the choice to put other. And I don't. They have unknown. I'll ask them, too, if they can give me an example of type. I lost my mouse, sorry. Okay, and then age group, again, middle age, which is encompasses the largest segment of the population. And then males are, I think that more males ride, so that would probably be the reason for that larger representation. I don't know what this curb. So someone hit a curb and crashed. Probably a single vehicle crash. So that's that one. So the question now is, you know, what are we going to do about this? And it's pretty. If there's no, I'm kind of going to go into a little discuss or throw out some information if there's no more questions at this point. So what are we going to do about this? So it's an exciting time here in the city of Tucson, and for me in particular and DTM, because of the passage of, as you probably know, Prop 411 has given us, and Prop 407 has given us, a big influx of money. And I did want to share, this website's pretty, if you don't know it, it's pretty cool. It's, if you just Google Tucson Delivers, they have all the, they've put all the local funding, not RTA and not like federal money, but all the local funding in all one place. Better streets. We internally refer them as like Prop 411, Prop, you know, 401, and that's easier. But this, they've kind of put the ballot names on. So Better Streets is Prop 101, which was primarily arterial resurfacing, and that program is pretty much complete. Parks and Connections included parks, and then Connections were bike boulevards, if you're familiar with that. It's basically saying that we'd rather provide a low stress low-volume cycling connection across town on residential streets rather than asking people to ride their bike down Speedway. And that the big part of that is putting traffic circles and speed humps along those local streets so that it discourages higher vehicle speeds. And then when you come to, if you're traveling east-west parallel to Broadway, when you come to Alvernon, they're installing a hawk there to get people across those busy streets. So that's a big one. I think this is going to be a national model, for the country to see what types of things you can do to get people safely across parallel to major routes. And then the Prop 411 is better streets, safe streets. The public thinks a lot. I get the sense the public thinks a lot about this being for local road resurfacing, and it is. But there's a good amount of money in there for safety, which is this is the part that gets me excited because I'm going. This map depicts the phasing of the resurfacing on the local streets, which I'm not really involved in. But the part that I get excited about is these ones: sidewalk and pedestrian exit. Accessibility improvements, bicycle network enhancements, system-wide safety, which includes hawks and traffic signal technology upgrades, $30 million. These are over the 10-year period. So what does that mean? So that means more hawks, which I'm hoping will address some of these pedestrian crossing, mid-block, give them a device they can use to get across the street.
Can you explain a hawk? That's not a familiar term to me.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, so that's the one if you're coming along a busy road and you see it's got the wigwag, the red and the, it goes red flashing back and the pedestrian goes across and then you can proceed once they reach the curb. Are you familiar with that one?
I'm not.
Let's just take you there. Rob Campbell and Knight is one. And we have, so this device was developed in Tucson, believe it or not, was approved by the federal government. Where's Knight? Here we go. And so we have about, so we're the leader in the nation on these. We have over 140 and we're installing somewhere around 10 a year. And so what it's this thing here. So basically it's very efficient and safe because what happens is that traffic normally moves. It's normally off and dark, we call it. You can just pass through. And then you push the button and almost immediately the walk sign comes off and this turns red. And then, persons can cross. Once they get past your side of the roadway, it changes to flashing red and you're allowed to proceed. And these are great because they don't disrupt traffic flow significantly and they provide a sort of auxiliary signal. Because you have a signal at like Broadway and Campbell, but you don't want a signal that's turning on red all the time, a few hundred feet away. So it's kind of like on demand. So that's a big tool in our toolbox. We're also doing, we're working on, as I showed in the data, we don't see a lot of left turn vehicle pedestrian crashes. But we're working to try and make it so that all our signals have red arrows. So if someone pushes the button, then they can't turn left until that pedestrian has cleared the roadway. So those are kind of like high level things we're doing. At the end of the day, as sad as it is, over 90% of these incidents are behavior related. So it's really tough, as an engineer to sort of engineer ways to force people to behave correctly, if that makes sense. It's more about like influencing, what can I do to like really encourage people to do the right thing?
Question on major streets like Broadway and Grant, most of them have a 40 mile an hour speed limit, which is never even met. And between the major intersections, the traffic lighting is really not what I would call clear. So while people seem to suddenly appear out of mid the block, I've many times seen them in time to stop, but they were in my headlights when I saw them.
Yeah, I mean, I've observed this the same thing. I mean, I don't drive at night anymore if I can avoid it, because just because of that. And I'm not sure I got a question out of there other than,
well,
yeah.
A combination of the speed permitted on these roads and the illumination of the roadways, I guess.
I guess so there's kind of three topics there. One is roadway illumination. So, you know, all of our roadways that are modern are illuminated to the standard. I mean, we don't want to over illuminate. And that's really the only thing I can comment there. The traffic signal, the speed limits. I see Lois has her hands up, or Commissioner Lois Pollock. Just let me finish one more thought, is that speed limits. I did want to mention this. So the city, everyone's probably heard, or hope you have, of the bipartisan infrastructure bill that was passed a little over a year ago. One part of that is called SS4A, Safe Streets for All. And what that means is that, the county and the city partnered on an application. They got, I think, $1.3 million. And they're just going to be, the county's the lead agency, and they're kicking off a region-wide outreach effort to basically get feedback, like you're giving me, from the entire community on sort of hot spots where, you know, safety dollars should be allocated and this type of thing. And then when that exercise is completed, they'll be able to apply for infrastructure money to basically build whatever that study produces. One piece that I'm fighting for in that effort is a system-wide evaluation of all the speed limits, like you mentioned, because these were set, they're set by council ordinance. You know, the process really is that I give, you know, we do a study and give our recommendation, but it's really a daunting task, and we're just kind of like piecemealing it as we get inquiries. But this report, this SS4A study, I'm hopeful that someone can take a comprehensive look at like all the crash data, all the speed data, and figure out what the appropriate speed limit is. Because as we know, you know, these roads have grown over time, populations have grown in certain areas and all of this. So, you know, you build, you know, you approve a housing complex and no one, you know, it's not on the road. So no one really thinks to take that into consideration. So holistic, I'm saying a lot of words here, but the idea is like, can we do a holistic approach and see what makes sense?
I know it's a political issue when the traffic cameras
yes.
are taken down.
Yeah.
Is there any movement to bring those back? I think that since we do not have sufficient police presence on the roads, those cameras would probably do a lot to keep people at least to the posted speeds.
Yeah, so the good news is that the state of Arizona allows, some states outlaw them completely. So you can't, even a local agency like Tucson couldn't have them. But the state did not do that. They said that it's up to the local agencies. So that, to me, I think that's going to need to be like a grassroots effort in combination with political will. I think that my understanding of the program was there was, I shouldn't speculate, but I've heard that there was zero tolerance, and I don't think that's the right way to operate. I think there should be some, you know, if you cross the line right at that second, that's just too strict. I mean, then people are thinking you're just on a money grab. The other part, that was red light violations. The other one is speed violations, and we've never done that here, as far as I know.
Well,
But I support, I support it.
Those speed things on River Road.
Yeah, yeah.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple.
Mr. Andrews?
Mr. Olofsson, in looking at some of these dots that are posting for accident locations, does this tend to tie to a demographic within our community of, you know, a socioeconomic standard, like where people are without transportation, they use bicycles more, more pedestrians? Is there a relationship there versus guys that are riding bicycles down the side of the road for exercise? And
yeah. Yeah, I the answer is yes. I can't, I'm reluctant to elaborate on that because it's really kind of a sensitive topic, but we did do pedestrian safety action plan, which we want to roll into this SS4A study because it came out with a lot of good recommendations, and I can share that with you guys too. I'll put that. And it did look at US Census data and, you know, and the, what would the board be? The components or the triggers for, you know, low income, disabled, no access to car. And then it overlaid that with the crash data, like you're mentioning, exactly like that. And they, so that came out with basically saying that, you know, you really need to target your resources in this area because these people, you know, they're just, you know, they're in that condition, right? And that's going to be a big part of the SS4A because equity, I mean, it's a buzzword, but it's a real thing. And that will certainly be addressed. You know, I also, you know, I don't know what areas you drive, but, you know, Stone is very problematic just because of the, and I think some of those dots line up there on that map on the pedestrian fatalities. Just because of the demographics. I mean, it's kind of what we're challenged with.
Blake, I got a question after you're done too, sir.
Well, go ahead, Lois, while you're up.
Okay, Blake, you guys have been putting in these hawks for years. I want to see the data. You can't keep spending $10,000 a hawk, whatever the dollar number is, and saying this is the answer, or you hope it's the answer, or you hope it's going to change people's culture, but you hope it incentivizes them to cross at the hawk, but it doesn't do it. There are some hawks that are very successful, and other ones, you watch the people walk between the hawks. You know, they just won't use them. So I want to see the city do some data, return on investment. For every 10,000 you spend, how many lives have you saved? And you guys everybody can look at the numbers for 2023 and see that they're higher than 2022 as far as deaths of pedestrians and bicyclists. So how do you guys, I mean, you can't just spend the money and say the more money we spend, the safer it's going to be. It's ridiculous. I mean, I saw you guys put in speed humps on Columbus, the city did. And they're between Speedway and Fifth. And I was driving down there just, you know, by chance one day, and somebody went into the middle lane to get around the speed hump, and the bicyclist on the other side started crossing the road. I don't know why, because he was going into traffic. But those speed humps were put there for the bike boulevard crossing, because the street doesn't meet up east to west. You have to go out into Columbus, jog down one direction or the other, and then back over to the street. So you have people driving around those speed humps. You have them driving through. I don't think the drivers have a problem with the hawks so much. It's the pedestrians. So how are you working with agencies like TPD to get out there and start giving some jaywalking tickets? You can't just expect these people to comply because you spent $10,000 for a hawk. That's our tax dollar money. And it really is very annoying. You're not going to change anybody's mind. They're widening Grant Road. Everybody crosses Grant Road wherever they want to. And if you look at your own statistics, you'll see that a lot of people are under the influence of some drug or alcohol. Putting in a hawk is not going to save a life where somebody is just practicing that on a regular basis. I mean, I've yelled out my window a number of times at people who cross, not at the crosswalk, at a light, an official crosswalk. I say, please use the crosswalk. And they give me the big, you know, whatever words they have in their mouth back at me. They don't care. And in fact, I drove to the airport one day, southbound on Alvernon. And here it's 5:30 in the morning. It's blackout. And two cars, me going southbound, one going northbound. And a pedestrian walks off the curb, goes in front of me. And I fortunately saw him. And then I stopped there because I knew there was going to be, I figured there would probably be a pedestrian flying in the air because that other person didn't see him. That guy walked, the jaywalker walked right in front of that car, barely missed the guy. You're not going to change that putting a hawk out. And you guys put hawks where we don't want you to put them. You maybe have, oh, one person got killed here, let's put a hawk there. You have your own statistics that show where these people are getting killed. Why are we putting hawks in other places where your statistics do not warrant it? I don't need, and you guys did this in my neighborhood. You put a hawk on Alvernon, barely over one block from Speedway, the crosswalk at Speedway and Alvernon. We begged TDOT not to put it there because no one should be crossing there anyhow, because there was nowhere to cross to and from. There was no school. There was a single convenience market. We couldn't convince you to put it down just two more blocks. Oh, no, we can put another one in. No. And I totally disagree with what you said about they don't cause a traffic issue. They absolutely do, because they are not timed with the lights. And we all know how, or maybe we all don't know how it works. But you get up there, you're a pedestrian, you press the button, and it goes off onto red. And I don't care if that car just started up 5 seconds ago from the light. Now it's got to stop at another one. It's infuriating drivers. It's making them go faster and hit people. It's just, you guys need to look at your own data.
Commissioner Pollack, can I ask you to hold up a minute and let our guests answer some of those questions?
Well, you know, I'm not sure there's a question there. I can't speak the specific location or the behaviors of specific individuals. When we look at pedestrian fatality, you know, the state pegs it at $6 million. And, you know, if a hawk costs $10,000, I consider that a success in my mind. As far as delaying drivers, I'm happy to wait for, you know, a mother and her child to cross the street and be delayed a few extra seconds. But I guess that's just a matter of opinion.
Well, I guess part of that question is, what is the procedure that goes through to determine where you place a hawk?
Well, it's really complicated in some sense, because what we've been doing, we've been getting 100% funded Highway Safety Improvement Project funded from the federal government. And they will only accept locations based on cost-benefit ratio. So if there's a pedestrian fatality at a certain location or a number of severe crashes, then we can apply and they will fund it competitively, because we compete against all the other agencies in the state. That's one source. One source is through RTA projects. If you participate in that design development process, you can have input on the location of it. And I mentioned the bike boulevard. So they're trying to identify, all those are published on the website, the routes. So those would get one on the either, you know, where it crosses a major street. So there's it just varies on how one location is determined. I can say that, you know, I've seen locations where I didn't think that they got used, and we pulled the data from the controller cabinet and it was acted. There's one on Stone, I think, that gets used 145 times a day. So there's people there that I think want to use them. certainly maybe some could be located, should have been located at a better place, but there's some thought that goes into it. That's all I can say.
Sure. Mr. Andrews?
Yes. Mr. Olson, a couple other questions. In gathering this data, along with the speed limits that are posted, do you guys check to see if the speed limit is posted by engineering analysis, by legislative action because the city council wanted the speed limit lowered? And how does speeds, vehicle speeds, compare with these incidents, if at all? In other words, if the speed limit is way too slow, does that mean that some traffic's going fast and it creates a more reckless environment on the roadway? Is there a comparison done in that regard?
Yeah, yes and no. So we use a federal FHWA, Federal Highway Administration. They published a tool where you enter all sorts of data. You enter all the crash data, the existing speed data, the number of driveways, the traffic volume, a bunch of information, and it analyzes it and gives the engineers a suggested posted speed. And then we are, my division, you know, through our experience, looks at it and agrees or disagree with it. Vast majority of the time we agree with it. And we would make a recommendation to council. So the problem is, like I said before, is no one's looked at these speed limits. You know, I've only been at the city 5 years. I couldn't even guess when the last time someone looked at them comprehensively. So that's a goal. And that is a method that no one's cooking the books, right? I mean, it's all legitimate engineering basis. And then again, the council would make the final decision. So we do get, if an individual citizens, we've had three this month, by the way, where individual citizens said, I don't think the speed limit's set here. And sometimes they think it's too high and sometimes they think it's too low. But we try to look at, like we did it on Broadway, look at the whole corridor, right? So land use changes as you go east and west, and the traffic volume changes. So we're trying to put like logical breaks in it. I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but that's what I want to do for the entire city at some point. And then the last thing you mentioned, traffic flow. So all our signals, believe it or not, are timed for the speed limit, usually slightly under. So if it's 40, I think it's 36. So in a perfect world, you would get a green all the way across town, which we know none of us do. And that's because of when the emergency services, they have preemption. So it turns the signal a certain way and it takes like three full cycles for it to catch up. As Commissioner Pollock mentioned, you know, the Hawks disrupt. They're not coordinated, so they disrupt further. But we do have studies that show we partner with the University of Arizona, and we retime two corridors a year, and we show usually a 30% drop in travel time when we do that. And there's all kinds of other factors like clock drift and the time it takes the one signal to talk to the other, where it kind of gets off kilter. But all in all, I think that considering the size of Tucson, it's pretty efficient. We have our problem areas like I-10 and Speedway and Congress and that, but that's more has to do with the road is really under capacity. The physical road is under capacity.
One last question. Mr. Olson, I was wondering if there's most of the data you presented is maybe a year old or thereabouts. On some of the newer roads, Grant Road in particular, the section from about Campbell to Oracle, they're intentionally putting, I don't know, curves in the road. Is that having a positive effect on incidents, accidents, and so on by design? Does that slow traffic? Does it make drivers more aware? Is there feedback from those newer
roads? If you're talking about the indirect lefts, is that what you're referring to, where can't make a left at Grant and Stone?
No, actually, it has to do with the road itself. Rather than being straight and linear, they have curves in the road meandering back and forth.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's traffic control.
No. So I don't know if you've driven the new Broadway section, Broadway West, we call it, from Euclid to Country Club, and it has those curves in it. And that is a direct result of real estate constraints. When they widened the road, you know, they bought the Burger, you know, and I'm in traffic. This is engineering. I'm speaking for them. You know, they bought the Burger King at Grant and Alvernon. They bought, I can't remember what the other part, there was like a, other route. Anyways, the point is that, you know, if they can, when they design it, and it's not me, when they design it, they can save millions and millions, tens of millions of dollars by not buying a certain parcel and having the road curve. The only way to control speeds, besides putting a governor in someone's car, which will never happen, is horizontal or vertical deflection. So that's why we put speed humps in local roads, because you have to go over it, you have to slow down. A curve in the road tends to slow traffic, because you have to maintain a speed to navigate it. Now, whether there's more crashes before or after, haven't looked into that. The problem is that, you know, to be statistically significant, to make a conclusion, you need at least three better 5 years of crash data to make a firm, you know, not speculating.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Commissioner Pogue, I interrupted you before. Do you have any further questions?
You know, not really. My questions always never get answered. You know, just like I said, Blake, you say reactively you guys put in a hawk and you figure out, you know, that one life is worth, I don't know, whatever. But the frustrating part of working with you guys is once you decide to do something, you will never not do it. So, and part of the problem is that, like the hawks, what I suspect happens is, like what you said, you get federal money. Well, you've applied for a certain intersection, I'm assuming. And once you make that application, you can't turn it backwards. So we're getting stuff that we may not even need.
Yeah.
You know, and it's because somebody decided we're going to have it there. It's just ridiculous. I hate seeing money spent like that. You need to, and look at the statistics. If you guys are trying to prevent accidents, you can look at your own data, and you have these great charts of where everybody got hit and everything, but those aren't necessarily where the hawks are going in. And besides,
you know that.
That's okay. It's just frustrating to me. You know where the speeding is because you guys got those speed trailers out everywhere. I wrote TDOT right after we had our speed trailers here, and that was about 3 months ago. They never wrote me back to see if I could get the speed data. I know that they have it, although one of the speed trailers was broken half the time it was here. It got pushed over to the side. But I know you guys have the data. I just don't feel like you use it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. It's frustrating to be in these neighborhoods with these speeding and people getting hit, or animals are getting hit. So that part's frustrating. The other part is, I totally agree with what you guys had. They had already announced, and I don't know if it was you, that they're going to do an evaluation of all the speed limits around town. Because some of them, like you're down on Palo Verde where there's no homes and you're supposed to be going 40 miles an hour near the old Holodome where they've got some stuff set up down there and down by the swap meet. But then I've got that same speed limit through residential areas and people are going 50, 55, and they're killing people when they're crossing the street. I just had a winter visitor hit and severely injured on Alvernon. We desperately need a hawk And we need some stuff in the middle of the street to slow people down, keep them from driving up the middle of the left-hand turn lane. I mean, I'm happy to see that you guys are doing some things, but I'm worried about the Hawks. Hawks are not the answer. They're not the answer. You can't take one of these components and install it and say, done. No, you got to be working with TPD. The city needs a huge outreach campaign about how to cross a street, when to cross, and you need to follow it up with tickets for jaywalkers. Yeah. Even if they don't ever pay them, because a lot of them might be homeless or whatever, they need it, and they need to know there's a message. Now, instead, Tucson has always been this, we can't do that. You know, people can't, you know, we can't, you know, and it's just so weird.
Why don't you let our guests answer some of those?
It's frustrating.
Commissioner Paul, those are fair criticisms, and those are, I know it's frustrating working with government. I work for the government, and it's frustrating. We do the best we can, and there's no ill intent, and we can always do better. I guess that's what I can say. I did want to share one last thing since you mentioned the Hawks, and I know Commissioner Paul's not a fan, but when I came here to the city 5 years ago, all we had was a spreadsheet list of possible locations, and that was archaic, right? So what we've built now, and I'm going to share this just for fun, since I think we still have time. So what we did is we took that spreadsheet list from how many years old it was, and we mapped it, and so this is a map of all the people that call up and request a Hawk, and there's like over 300 on here. Does it make sense to have a Hawk at every location? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Does it make sense to have one, you know, like 300 feet apart? Absolutely not. So what we're trying to do, and so two things on this. One is each location is ranked based on traffic volume, crash data, equity scoring, this type of thing. And, so we're trying to use data to make decisions where it makes sense to have one. We're just, you know, we just, I just got this map made last calendar year, and I'm like dying to give it to this SS4A planning group so that someone can have some time to weed through it, and it'll be a public process and say, yes, no, yes, no. Move this one a little further that way. So I'm not wholesaling Hawks, but I don't want them to go on the wrong location. They're extremely expensive, but I do think they do provide benefit, especially if they're located properly, like near a school, you know, near a library, near a shopping center. So that's one thing we're working on.
I have a question.
And I think it's great that you have that map now. But you know what? One thing that doesn't happen, you never involve the neighborhoods that they're in. And so we get the notice after it's a done deal.
Yeah.
And so I would encourage the city to involve the neighborhoods. You've got 154, 100 and some odd neighborhoods. And we all have an interest in this. And we all live here, so we know the pedestrian patterns. But they never tell us. And it's very frustrating.
I can't argue with you there, and I can imagine how frustrating that is.
But I will
pass that on, certainly.
But there are some, like I said in the beginning, there's some very well used Hawks.
Yes.
And they're great tools. So yeah, it's a mixed bag. But thanks for listening.
No, that's what I'm here for.
I think Mr. Aaron.
Like, I have a quick question if you have time. So the map that you have, so at the city we have some GIS overlays on various things, right? So we can pull up the map and filter it by bus stops and then city-owned property, for example, if we want to track that way. The one that you have that was calls for Hawks, so citizen input.
So I don't know where the list came from. Like I said, I came to the city 5 years ago, and they had done this ranking process like one time before I came. And all I know is what I can remember. Someone told me these were all the requested locations, or if we're aware of an incident or a new school, someone would add it, you know, just don't know. And then we did, we have what, hate to use these words, but we have what we call uncontrolled mark crosswalks. So that's a crosswalk across Speedway with nothing. And you're just supposed to expect that someone's going to stop for you, which is not going to happen. So we identified all those recently last, that was a big effort too. So this, each dot represent, you have to, you can click on it and see what the data is, but we identified what we believe is a comprehensive list that contains all the requested locations. Oh, and all the planned ones that are funded and all the uncontrolled. So the idea is to refine this, just keep working on it over time, but they are ranked using equity and traffic volume and crash data. So we know where to start our effort at the top, right? So we're going to, you know, one's ranked number one, you know, we're not just going to close our eyes and work on the, you know, number 400. So that's the goal. This map is internal right now to DTM, but there's no reason our GIS folks couldn't publish it or share it in any way form. There's nothing to hide here. So it's just data.
All right. How about the, so the heat maps that you presented, those are PAG information. Do you know if we incorporate that currently with any of the GIS overlays?
So PAG is its own entity and you're smiling. So no, that's not shared. You can request data layers from them, but they don't publish it.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
I have one last question, if I may. I live off an intersection where there is a cutout for left turns, and it's basically a two-lane road. And the way it's set up, if you are planning to make a, like this happens to be on Rosemont and Broadway, you're going to make a left turn onto Broadway, you cannot see the oncoming traffic on Rosemont. And it's the way that the intersection is structured, but you cannot see oncoming traffic. And I'm sure this occurs on more heavily traveled intersections.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that intersection. So are you talking about, are you going north or south or east or west?
Usually I go north on Rosemont and turn east on Broadway.
Yeah. So you mean west?
Yes.
Anyways, yeah, so that's programmed for left turn phases. So there'll be an arrow there. I don't know the exact timing of that. So basically, if you're going left, you just kind of, the best thing to do is wait.
The arrow's on the lights facing Broadway. There is no arrow.
Yeah. Correct. We're going to be adding those in response to another complaint. Yeah.
But the structure of many of the intersections are that way, the cutouts and the difficulty in seeing the oncoming traffic.
Agreed. And so we're going down a rabbit hole here, but we're trying to, most of our signals don't have red arrows, so we can't even hold the cars. So it's like green ball, it's called permissive. So basically turn when it's safe. You've probably seen the flashing yellow arrows, love them or hate them, but the idea there is that it's more cognitive. Studies show that people for some reason understand that they are supposed to be careful, but the other part of that is they do include red arrows at the top, and so we're gonna be looking at. That's my next goal, is to look at all the crash data and start thinking proactively about which intersections. It's just not a good idea to allow people to make those decisions themselves. They need to be told because they can't see, right? I think you're nodding, so I hope you agree, but it's just something that it's allowed. I could show you the left turn crash data, and it's not, it's not anywhere near, you know, it's like five or six a year, but these are people, right? So we need to, we can always do better.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions?
No, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Ms. Pollock, I've cut you off twice. Do you have any further questions?
You know what? Just one real quick. Blake, you mentioned, now that we're talking about the left-hand turn arrow on these streets, do you know when you guys are going to do that study? Because we've got the Grant Road widening coming up in our area, and everybody's using Alvernon to turn onto east or westbound Pima. And then same thing from Pima onto east or westbound Alvernon. We're having an accident every few days, either at Alvernon and Pima, and we're also having an accident every couple of days at Pima and Columbus. We have so much extra traffic, cut-through traffic, of people that don't live here. They're just cutting down from Grant. We desperately need these left-hand turn arrows because people, you're supposed to be going 30 on Pima, but they're not. I personally myself saw four cars turn on a red light the other day when I was on Pima at Alvernon. We can't get TPD because there's not enough people. And most of these accidents don't get reported to TPD unless there's a fatality or they tie up the whole intersection.
You guys
don't have adequate data to even assess where these left-hand turn signals should be installed. But we were told somebody is thinking about it, basically, but we need to know, when's it going to happen? So do you guys know when you're going to start analyzing where new left-hand turn signals are going to go
up? I mentioned, so backing up. So we do take, there are, I don't, guidelines is too soft of a term, but there are procedures where we follow that determine whether a left turn arrow is warranted. And we do analyze each and every one that we're asked about every year. I was kind of referring to more of a new effort that I want to make citywide to look at these left turn arrows, primarily on dual left hand turns on these huge intersections where vehicles are moving faster. There's a lot more vehicles. I'm not discounting Pima and Alvernon and Columbus. I wrote it down. I'll look at it. But we kind of start at the top. We also have, you guys could keep me, we should have beers or something, but the PAG data explorer, they do this thing called predictive modeling where they take the traffic data, crash data, and then they kind of rank the intersections worst to best. And so that's, we're starting at the top. So that's, you know, that's, we got to start somewhere, right? So this is what I'm, my goal for, I got the Hawk map going. So now I can work on that. And so I'm trying to do this next. But I wrote Pima and Columbus, Alvernon, and I know that I have your contact information, Commissioner Pollock. So I'll, we'll get back to you.
Hey, I really appreciate the input. Thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate you taking the time with us. I don't think we have any further questions at this point. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate it. And I would glad to come back next year or whenever you need me.
Okay. Good luck this year.
Thank you. Bye, guys.
Bye. Do we have an audience?
Does not appear so, and I do not see anybody online. Next agenda item is future agenda items.
Yeah. Hey, future agenda. I didn't make the last meeting, but I see we have three vacancies now. Did people just, I'm assuming Commissioner Hunter termed out. Is that correct?
That is good. So we have a vacancy mayor's office that's been vacant. The commission did send a follow-up letter. I have not heard anything back. I inquired after our last meeting with city manager's office, because lots of times mayor office communicates that direction. They haven't heard anything back either. Commissioner Hunter termed out. Did she term out? She put in her resignation as of the end of the year. She gave 6 months notice to the her appointee ward that she met with that ward. They are aware of the vacancy and are actively trying to fill it. The other vacancy is Commissioner Mark Rodriguez. Every year we have to do a attendance log for the clerk's office, and that's updated after every meeting. Per the statute, if you miss consecutive meetings, I believe it's 4, then you're automatically off of the board. Or if you miss 40% or more meetings within a calendar year, then that also triggers the removal from boards and commissions. Mr. Rodriguez missed 40% or more of the meetings in calendar year 2023, so the clerk's office did remove him from the board. His ward office was also notified, but I have not heard back from them.
What I'm kind of wondering is, do we need, I mean, I would be perfectly willing to go to a city council meeting and advocate for the mayor to fill the seat. We sent the letter, but, you know, often we don't get replies from the mayor's office. And so, you know, I'm just thinking maybe if we take it to a public venue and it gets published, you know, by, what do they call it? Called the audience. Maybe that could help, but without more people, we can't do much. I'm confident that Ward 3 will probably find somebody. Ward 1, I don't know. I don't know enough about. Is there a brand new? I can't remember.
Yeah. It's a valid strategy, but you do have you as a board have the access to not wait for a call to the audience. We could try to schedule your time on a mayor and council agenda if you choose for an update and advocate for filling positions, maybe bring up the importance of the board, reference the charter, what you're tasked with.
Could that not be on the agenda?
On the mayor and council agenda?
No, on this commission's agenda.
Yeah, it could be a future agenda item if you want to and discuss the strategy going forward.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. You know, maybe we could discuss what we should do in order to get more people, you know, get all of our vacancies filled. So that is a future agenda item.
Near future, one hopes.
Okay, it sounds like Commissioner is on board with that, so we will add it to the future agenda.
So I'd like that to be on the future agenda. And then I don't want to take time away from you guys, but I was doing some thinking, and instead of the, you know, how we have on the future agenda for TPD and hiring and all that kind of stuff, but really what you kind of want to look at is, or what I'd like to look at instead, is the usage, basically the use of the resource. So how are TPD resources being utilized? And is it, are there other city departments that could possibly be helping making that resource more useful or, you know, less wasteful or whatever? And I'm just going to be really quick example. One is TPD knows which properties in the city are their highest call volume. And they have some initiative called PNI, which is Place Network Investigation. And they've been using this tool now for a couple of years at least to focus in on the highest crime, and it's really focused on gun violence. But there's one, for instance, there's one property in our area where a single rent, and it's an apartment building, and there's something like 8% of the calls or something, pretty big percentage in Midtown Division is used at this one location. And so I just kind of wanted to maybe have this stuff figure into the future agenda, because there's issues with rentals that we always, in neighborhoods, we say, hey, they get their own paid security service, and it's called Tucson Police Department. And so there's not an expectation placed on some of these property, some of these rental owners. There's no expectation by the city attorney's office. And I'm wondering, would it be beneficial to look at, you know, how these other departments, such as the attorney's office, is inadvertently tying up resources for TPD that could be used other places. So, for instance, when there's a pretty bad crime that goes on, we had one in our area, I don't know, a couple of years ago, that was gun violence. Some drug dealers were living in a triplex, and there were some gunshots fired, and I got notified by neighbor, go over there, drive by. I knew who the owner was just because I already talked to them, called them on the phone and said, hey, did you know about this gun violence at your complex? Well, it was just by happenstance that they got notified by their repairman or rental manager or something. TPD does, the city of Tucson does not have any process in place that they follow where if you have a bad incident happen at your rental property that they notify the owner. And so these bad incidences just keep reoccurring and TPD keeps using resources. And it takes years for the city attorney's office to even think about contacting one of them and saying, hey, you're using too many resources. You're going to have to get your own security and clean up your building. So anyhow, the gist of it is I would like to put on the future agenda that we start looking at other city departments that support TPD to ease up the resources that they're going to need, because we're not going to get any more officers faster than any other city. And so it would be beneficial maybe to start looking at, say, the city attorney's office and asking them, how's this handled? What are you doing? You know, they don't appear to be moving very fast at all on anything like that. So anyhow, that's my 2 cents on future agenda. Instead of just keep going after, hey, how are we hiring more people? You know, it's they're going to do it as fast as they can. So there's nothing, I haven't learned anything in these meetings that we've had that says there can be a different impact. I don't know if it's worth continuing to follow that topic.
All right, so it's a lot in there. Maybe an approach is TPD is in their budget cycle. They do have, so kind of their organizational chart, each little division figures out that we could probably have somebody from the Midtown division come in, talk about how they do allocate their resources, what their challenges are, and maybe address some of those types of questions so we can figure out what you want to look at or what other divisions might be affected.
It's not so much asking TPD. I think we need to go out and ask, like, the city attorney's office, how are you working with TPD to free up their resources? Are you supporting them when they have repeat incidences at the same properties or properties that are owned by the same people? Because there's people here that own multiple complexes that are problem properties. So I'm looking really more for the city attorney's office.
I don't know at what point they're pulled into the process.
I don't think they, think it's really pretty far down the line. Anyhow.
Well, I have a comment after listening to you, Commissioner Pollack, and certainly what you're addressing is that the city utilize the police force as best it's able. But the problem that we were looking at is them being sort of understaffed, almost continually understaffed, losing officers to other jurisdictions, and finding out maybe the whys and what's being done to address that. I don't live in probably what I consider an area of a lot of incidents, But I know that if I call Tucson police for something that I consider a need, they're going to not even respond unless there's a threat against me or someone of violence. And our city never used to be this way, and it is now. It seems like being short 80 to 130 officers has impacted the quality of, well, civility and lawfulness within the community. And it seems to be directly tied to police staffing. And I think that's something that's worth looking at and finding why this is a continuing problem.
If I could comment on that, several of the people in my, I happen to live in a gated community, and several of the community owners have cameras that are triggered by motion. And there have been a number of instances where people have, late at night, have been stalking around the grounds. I'm not aware of any current break-ins, but people who are not members of the community late at night seem to be looking
for opportunities.
And contacting the police gives, they don't even respond. So I agree with you on that.
Oh, I totally agree with you guys on that. If you want to continue looking at that, I wasn't sure where it was headed, because it just seems like it. We get the same information, and then it just kind of dies. I just wasn't sure about, but anyhow, I'm totally fine with that. So then I'd like to add something, because and that would be with the city attorney's office, trying to figure out, how can we, because if you have a lack of resources, it's because either you have too few officers, like you're saying, but that's America right now. Everybody has too few. And so you also want to know, what are they doing to be more efficient or more effective, and that they don't need all the officers. So they are doing a lot of different things, but I want to know how the city attorneys are supporting them. Because if you talk to the officers candidly, they would tell you that they're not well supported. They go out and they get them. Oh man, they are so energetic, and they're so ecstatic when they finally catch a bad guy, but then they get turned loose right away by the county attorney. And see, that's another thing that I'm not sure who's involved in what. What are the county attorneys involved in as far as retaining people, and what are the city attorneys involved in? And it would be beneficial probably to know the difference between those and who's doing what, because there's a lot of people who are mad about property crime, and because basically not much is done unless it's a felony, and that is something like, I don't know now, $1,500 or something. But anyhow, so yeah, I think maybe we could add on something that was related to TPD, retention and recruiting and everything. And what are we doing to make these people happy so they'll stay? Because if they get so discouraged because they go out and they catch these people, and they're just, really doing a fantastic job doing that, then they get turned loose the next day. They're so discouraged. They don't want to work for a city that has that kind of a, place that, it's not a game, but that kind of commitment to the officers. It's depressing, I would think. They just keep fighting that. And when you talk to them, that's what they say. So you don't, it's kind of along with, why are people leaving? And so, because if you could retain them, that would be wonderful. But I don't know if they've even figured out why they leave. It's not always all about money. So yeah, but often it is. But then they've also had, pay increases. They just did relooked at that, last year, the year before, and they had all kinds of pay increases. Well, what the heck happened? It didn't work. So maybe there's some other factors. So maybe when we keep talking to TPD, we can just start bringing up, okay, what are the other factors that are making people leave? And, why can't you keep them? But anyhow. That's my thought on that.
Thank you.
The items that I already have scheduled, trying to get staff lined up, are the TPD recruitment. broken out different than the TPD compensation plan. The CFO said those are really two different issues handled by different people in TPD. I have the construction punch list process, specifically with roadway projects. The vacancies on the IAPC. Okay, and then do we want to dial in this conversation on what you want on the attorney's office? Is there appetite there to have them come in and present on their overall process on how they support TPD? Other things that came up today, sounds like there is opportunity if you're more interested in the POC information. Blake mentioned that they did pull controller cabinet data, so that probably exists somewhere. You could probably get a presentation like today on actual HOC usage across the city. Commissioner Pollack mentioned the speed trailer data, which we weren't able to get DTM lined up with, but I can make another effort on
that. I would like to see that.
All right. So would the commission like me to add all of those? Would you like to vote on which ones you want to officially add to the future agenda items? And I can start lining up staff.
I would like to see all of those appear on the follow-up agendas.
Okay.
And scheduling is going to be your job, I think, trying to get people in and fit in the times.
Okay. Sounds good. We'll put the vacancies on the high priority because that's just internal.
Yeah.
And then I'll line up staff for the other items on availability. We'll see what we can do.
I don't know.
You know what that?
I'm sorry, Commissioner Pollack, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, Aaron has a very good handle on when we talk and say stuff. He gets it written down. I don't know how. So thanks. Yeah.
You're welcome.
I don't know if it's just the result of the pandemic, the lack of response from the mayor's office in terms of the vacancies, but aside from the one that was ongoing when I was appointed to the commission, the code enforcement by the then commissioner, then the councilman from Ward, was four, three?
The one that brought up the code enforcement?
Since that time, I have not seen anything from either the mayor's commission, or the mayor and council, or the city manager's office, and asking the commission to look into things.
Correct.
And I think one of the things we should discuss is the efficiency. Efficiency.
Yeah.
Thank you. And whether or not, and maybe that's something that should be put on when we're going to get on the agenda for the mayor and council. Is there a lack of confidence in the IAPC from the other city agencies?
Yeah, or unawareness that it's a tool that they can tap into. Yes, I agree. I think with the change in finance department, business services, management also, previously Joyce would come with periodically, here is something to look at. And with new people coming in, they might not realize that that's something that they can do.
Develop an advertising budget.
Right.
Yeah, I think that would be a great idea. When I was at the Ward 3 office last year at some presentation, I was talking to one of the head person at the Ward 3 office, and she didn't know anything about the IAPC. And she's been working as a ward person for quite a number of years for a couple of different council people. So it is time for a little presentation on what we do, what can be done, and how it could be helpful.
and how we can make it known.
Yes. All right, sounds good. The last item on the agenda is adjournment. Some of the commissions, on a ton of commissions, some actually do a motion and a vote and then adjourn. I think that is probably an official thing.
I think Robert's rule says that the commissioner or the chairman has the right to call the adjournment.
Yes.
Meeting is adjourned.
Thank you. All right, thank Perfect. You, everybody.
Hey, thanks for attending.
Adjudicated. The meeting's adjourned because there's nothing further. So I agree.
Yeah, that's the way I would.